Mit Hans-Jürgen Bartsch, heute Programm Cell Death in Development and Disease von Robert Horwitz. Liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, Donnerstag ist für gewöhnlich bei uns der Tag der Nobelpreisträger. In den zurückliegenden und folgenden Wochen senden wir Vorträge vom diesjährigen und alljährlichen Treffen der Nobelpreisträger in Lindau am Bodensee mit Nachwuchsforschern. Heute hören Sie einen Vortrag des Biologieprofessors Howard Robert Horwitz, den dieser am 29. Juni in dem idyllischen Städtchen gehalten hat. Horwitz ist 63 Jahre und arbeitet am Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, USA. Seine Großeltern waren von Russland und Galizien nach Amerika ausgewandert. In seinem Elternhaus standen Bildung und wissenschaftliche Neugier ganz oben auf. Nachdem Horwitz' Vater an einer degenerativen Nervenkrankheit gestorben war, beginnt sein Sohn damit, diese näher zu erforschen. 1972 schließt er sein Studium der Biologie ab, 1974 Dissertation und 1978 Assistenzprofessur in Cambridge. Als Professor für Biologie wirkt er dort nun schon seit 1986. Die prämierten Forschungen von Horwitz bauen darauf auf, dass ein einfacher Wurm im embryonalen Stadium über deutlich mehr Zellen verfügt als im späteren Leben. Dieser genetisch programmierte Zelltod firmiert unter dem Fachbegriff Apoptose. Die Übertragung dieses Phänomens ist auch auf den Menschen möglich. Störungen des Ablaufs sind ursächlich für Krebs, für Beeinträchtigungen der Autoimmunreaktionen und beispielsweise bei der Alzheimer-Krankheit. 2002 bekommt Horwitz für die Mechanismen, die er in diesem Zusammenhang aufgedeckt hat, den Nobelpreis für Medizin zugesprochen. Program Cell Death in Development and Disease von Robert Horwitz im Hörsaal.
I think I very briefly will cite the advice I was given when I was a graduate student by my PhD advisor Jim Watson, who is known for the Watson-Crick double helix. And Jim basically said, in choosing a problem, to think primarily about two things. First, the problem should be important because it's no harder to work on an important problem than on a non-important problem. And secondly, the problem must be tractable because no matter how important the problem, if you can't make headway, it won't help. Now, that's not to say that the problem has to be easily tractable, and you may have to innovate to make it tractable, but if you can't make it tractable, nothing is likely to come of it. Okay, so what I'm going to do this morning is tell you a little about a problem called programmed cell death, and I'll focus on findings from our research lab, talking mostly about some of the historical findings, but also trying to, at the end, bring you up to date with a message that basically says, science doesn't end. Discoveries lead to progress, but always, I think, to incomplete stories, and inform us better about what questions to ask going forward. So let me make some introductory comments about programmed cell death. Programmed cell death refers to the cell death that occurs as a normal aspect of the development of animals, and also to other cell deaths that use the same mechanisms as used in those naturally occurring cell deaths. And there are many, many examples of programmed cell death in biology. For example, if you think about the metamorphosis of a tadpole into a frog, the tail of the tadpole is lost. That tail consists of cells, the fundamental units of life, and those cells die. If you think about the development, for example, of a human embryo and a baby, in utero, between our digits, between fingers and toes, there are cellular regions that make for webs. And those cells die so that our fingers and toes become separate. This regulation can be controlled among species, so that if you think, for example, about ducks, some have webbed feet, very useful for swimming, some do not, and the difference is a difference in the regulation of programmed cell death. In the development of our brains, programmed cell death is very important. As many as 85% of the nerve cells that are generated as the human brain forms die. In our immune systems, as we sit here today, as many as 95% of certain of the blood cells involved in our immune responses, we generate, as many as 95% die by programmed cell death. Programmed cell death is pervasive in biology. And yet, I think not so many years ago, when biologists thought about cell death, and I probably should say if biologists thought about cell death, the basic thinking was cell death is not interesting, rather it's a phenomenon to be avoided, because what does a biologist do? Study cells that are alive. If cells die, you can't do your work. That's a problem, but it's not an interesting problem. What we know today is this is not the way to think about cell death in many cases. Cell death can be an active process on the part of cells that die. In particular, genes can act in cells to make those cells die. So there is a biology of cell death, every bit as much as there is a biology of other fundamental processes like cell division, cell migration, and cell differentiation. Now, where there is a biology, there also can be a pathology. Any normal biological process, if it goes wrong in us, can lead to disease, and programmed cell death is no exception to this. And there are many diseases now and this is just a short and somewhat old list, diseases that are known to be associated with abnormalities in cell death. In some cases, cells that should live die. For example, neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's, Huntington's, Parkinson's, ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, heart attacks, congestive heart failure, liver diseases, kidney diseases. We can go on and on with disorders in which cells die. And in at least some of these disorders, but not necessarily all, it has been shown that what is going on is an unleashing of the normal developmental program for cell death in the wrong cell types or at the wrong time. Conversely, there are disorders in which cells that should die instead live. For example, autoimmune disorders. In our immune system, we generate cells that have the capacity to recognize cells in our own body. And normally, these cells die by programmed cell death. If they do not, autoimmune disease results. In cancer people often think about as uncontrolled cell division. Cells divide and divide and divide, leading to too many cells. Well, in fact, the number of cells in our tissues is defined by two opposing processes, the process of cell division, which adds cells, and the process of programmed cell death, which removes cells. And the number of cells can be too high, either because of too much cell division or too little cell death. And certain cancers are fundamentally cancers that are caused by too little cell death, and it appears today that most, if not all, cancers involve too little cell death. Furthermore, some of the classic remedies, some of the treatments for cancer, radiation, chemotherapy, they act by activating the endogenous process of programmed cell death. So what this says is that an understanding of the biology, and the biologic mechanisms that are involved in programmed cell death is very important both to understanding biology and also to understanding and approaching treatments for a broad variety of diseases. And so what I'm going to tell you about now is the discovery and characterization of genes that function in this process of programmed cell death based upon work primarily from my laboratory over the years. And I want to say that we made these discoveries not focused on a human disease and even not focused on studies of a mammal, but rather using a very simple animal, a microscopic nematode or roundworm known as Caenorhabditis elegans. Now, this animal was introduced to modern biology by my friend, colleague, and mentor, Sidney Brenner, with whom I shared the Nobel Prize, and it was studied in detail by another friend, colleague, and mentor, John Sulston. And one thing that John did was to analyze the development of this very simple animal. It turns out this animal contains, as an adult, only about 1,000 cells. This is to contrast with us, where in our brains alone we have more than 10 to the 11th cells. And what John did was to study the cell lineage, starting, as all organisms do, from a single cell. C. elegans divides from one cell to two to four and so on. And this diagram depicts the developmental origin of every cell in the animal. The y-axis here is time, and each vertical line terminates in a cell. If you count quickly going across, you will see that there are 959 cells generated in the adult animal and an additional 131 cells that are generated but are not found in the adult animal. These 131 die developmentally by programmed cell death. And this is one thing that John Sulston established. Now, what we did was to seek genes involved in this process. We did this by looking for genetic variants, mutants, abnormal, and the patterns of programmed cell death, cells that should live die or cells that should die live. And in this way, we identified four steps in the process of programmed cell death. First, every cell in the animal must decide, I will live or I will die by programmed cell death. Second, for those cells that decide to die, they must literally execute that decision. Thirdly, dying cells, the corpses, must be engulfed by neighboring cells to remove those dying cells from the body of the animal. And fourth, the macromolecular debris of the cell corpse must be degraded. Another way to remember these steps is very simply indicated here. Identify the victim, kill, get rid of the body, and destroy the evidence. So that's the essence of programmed cell death. How did we get there? Well, again, we began with genetic studies. This is the nose of an animal. And in essence, what we did, and by we I mean a graduate student, Hilary Ellis, and all of the story that I will tell you about today was carried out experimentally by young students, graduate students, and postdoctoral researchers in the lab. Hilary Ellis is a graduate student. Basically looked for mutants in which those cells that die normally by programmed cell death do not. And what you can see here depicted with these arrows are cells that are in the process of undergoing programmed cell death, and here is a mutant in which those cell deaths cannot be seen. This mutant defined a gene which we called SED3 for cell death abnormal gene number 3. And it turned out that the mutation that perturbed this gene eliminates the function of the gene. So without SED3 function, cells that should die instead live. This very simply tells us what SED3 does. SED3 kills. Without SED3 function, programmed cell death does not occur. In further studies, this finding, let me back up for a moment, this finding led to a very important conclusion because it said since programmed cell death requires the function of a specific gene, this means that programmed cell death is an active biologic process. Cells are not dying by default. Something biologic is going on to cause them to die. We continued our studies, identified a second gene called SED4, which behaves very similarly to SED3. It, too, is required for killing. Then another graduate student, Junying Yuan, asked, where do these killer genes function? Do they function essentially as suicide genes within the cells that are about to die, or do they function elsewhere in the body, perhaps sending some signal throughout the body telling certain cells to die? And what she found was the answer is the former. Both of these genes act within cells that are going to die, saying that to at least this extent, programmed cell death is a process of cellular suicide. Junying Yuan and another graduate student, Shai Shaham, then characterized the SED3 gene molecularly and discovered that the SED3 protein looks like a protein just discovered, actually we had to wait for its discovery, by two pharmaceutical companies interested in human inflammatory disease. The SED3 protein is similar to a protein known as ICE, interleukin-1 beta converting enzyme. This is a protease, and this finding told us that SED3 likely acts as a protease, cutting up other proteins to drive the process of programmed cell death. And postdoctoral researcher Ding Xu, who had previously been trained by Marty Chalfi, from whom we're going to hear from next, demonstrated that, in fact, this is the case. It turned out that SED3 and ICE are the founding members of a family of proteases, today known as caspases, and many studies from many laboratories have shown that caspases drive programmed cell death, not only in C. elegans, but also probably in all animals, certainly including ourselves.
Wir senden für Sie auf D-Radio Wissen einen Fachvortrag in englischer Sprache unter dem Titel Programmed Cell Death in Development and Disease von Robert Horwitz. Nach wenigen Sekunden setzen wir die Ausführungen des Nobelpreisträgers fort.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit, die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Now, meanwhile, we kept looking for genes. SED4, we characterized molecularly 4 years later. Xiaodong Wang, working in Dallas, Texas in the U.S., found a human counterpart of SED4. It looks similar, and like SED4, it can drive the process of programmed cell death, which I should say often is referred to by a word that has four syllables, begins with A, and is pronounced in at least seven different ways. I'll leave it to you to choose how you would like to pronounce this. The Greek speakers in the room have probably the right answer, which none of the rest of us ever use. Then Ron Ellis, a graduate student in the lab, found another cell death gene, and this one was different from SED3 and SED4. Instead of being a killer, it is a protector. It protects cells against programmed cell death. Graduate student Michael Hengartner cloned this gene, SED9, and discovered it looks like a human cancer gene, a gene called BCL2. BCL stands for B-cell lymphoma. And this is a cancer gene that causes cancer by causing B-cells in our immune systems to not die. And that survival of these cells leads to their proliferation and the cancerous state. And BCL2, like SED9, protects against cell death. Now, people sometimes have asked me, have you ever had an aha moment, eureka, discovery? You know you're onto something that's important. And the answer here is that on February 12th, 1992, I was attending a conference, and graduate student Michael Hengartner was doing something worthwhile. He was working in the lab. He had identified the SED9 sequence. He did a computer search at this relatively early database, and he sent me this fax at the meeting, which says, guess what ends up at the top of the search? The answer, human BCL2. And this was the moment that we knew we not only were discovering a fundamental biological pathway in C. elegans that had some counterparts, but also that this pathway we were working on was going to be very important in the context of human disease, and at this point in particular in the context of cancer. Now, the similarity between SED9 and BCL2, both had similar sequence information, both protected against cell death, led us to ask the question, how close are these genes really? And we were able to show that the human BCL2 gene, if expressed in C. elegans, would work. And furthermore, if expressed in a C. elegans mutant defective in SED9 function, BCL2 would substitute for the worm gene. The fact that the human gene could substitute for the worm gene said not only are these genes piecemeal similar, but also there must be similar pathways. And we then worked out the basic pathway, and this core pathway looks as indicated here. SED3 caspase kills, SED4 kills by promoting the activity of SED3, and SED9 protects by preventing SED4 from promoting the activity of SED3. We kept looking. Next, we found, in work from postdoc Barbara Conrad, a third killer gene called EGL1. And what Barbara discovered was that EGL1 acts in the pathway at a different point than the other two killer genes, before rather than after SED9. So EGL1 kills by preventing SED9 from preventing SED4 from activating SED3. And this then proved to be the core molecular genetic pathway for programmed cell death, and subsequent experiments by a variety of labs showed that these proteins each interact physically, sequentially, EGL1 with SED9, SED9 with SED4, SED4 to SED3, and so this is both a biochemical and a genetic pathway for this core component of programmed cell death. Now, with this information, one can begin to think about applications to medicine. And the biotechnologies and pharmaceutical industries took note. In fact, the day we published our paper about SED3 as a caspase, I received telephone calls from 5 pharmaceutical companies, including one from an old friend who said, Bob, I have 100 people working on this caspase ice. Please tell me what we're studying. Okay. Since then, a variety of companies have pursued the human counterparts of these players in attempts to discover and develop therapies. For example, caste bases are killers, so that if you could inhibit a caste base, you could prevent diseases that have too much programmed cell death. The clinical efforts that have gone furthest are actually in the context of liver diseases in programs that are active today. Conversely, if you could inhibit a SED9-BCL2-like protective protein, you could activate cell death in cells that were otherwise being protected. Inhibition of BCL2 family members is an active area of interest for cancer, and there are a number of anti-BCL2 programs that are currently in what, to my eye, look very promising clinical trials for certain specific cancers. Okay, now let's go on beyond this core pathway. This is just the beginning. The next step, that of engulfment, of phagocytosis of the cell corpse, we also have worked out in some detail. We have studied what happens upstream of this core pathway, and it turns out that that first step of EGL1 driving the pathway is regulated by cell type in a very specific way at the level of gene expression with specific transcription factors controlling this process. Different cells are controlled by different transcription factors. We have worked out many cases in C. elegans. In each of these cases, we find human counterparts. In many of these cases, the human counterparts are shown to also act in cell death and apoptosis and human disease. Most of the ones that we've characterized are players in cancer. Here's one set of cells. Here's a second set of cells, but that's not always the case. And without going through the details, here is a picture of how this first killer gene in the killing pathway is regulated by different transcription factors in different cell types. We go on to another story to ask if the generalization, specific control of this gene, EGL1, and cancer is generalizable, and the answer is not always. There are always surprises, and I won't go through the details, but in fact, here is a case where we studied a particular kind of nerve cell death, a neuron in the head of the male that he uses to chemically sense the presence of the opposite sex, and in the other sex, which is not female but hermaphrodite, these cells are generated but die. So this is sexually dimorphic programmed cell death. And the primary regulation of this cell death is not the control of the EGL1 killer gene, but rather downstream, the control of the gene SED3. Okay, and this is work both done by Hillel Schwartz, a graduate student in my lab, and Barbara Conrad, who had been a postdoc in my lab, working independently. And interestingly, when we ask about human counterparts now and human disease, there are counterparts, but the disorder, at least from what's been seen in studies of mice, is not cancer, but rather a neurologic disorder, deafness. If the counterpart in mice is inactivated, the mouse is deaf. The reason is that the hair cells in the ear die, and what it looks like, but this is still a work in progress, not by us, but by the people who are interested in mice and deafness, what it looks like is that these hair cells are dying because the process of programmed cell death is activated, and that leads to the deafness. And this story comes, again, the understanding of this story comes from the study of a sexually dimorphic programmed cell death in C. elegans. Now, to go from there, many more genes, much pathway, human counterparts, various diseases, big picture, and then is this it? And the fundamental answer, and what I said at the beginning, is discovery leads to exception, leads to new discovery. As we look very carefully, we find that even in the absence of this SED3 caspase, there is some programmed cell death. Furthermore, the entire pathway that I've told you about is not needed for these few programmed cell deaths. There are other caspases encoded by the C. elegans genome, and we have eliminated all of them, and there is still programmed cell death. So no caspase, no core pathway, still a little bit of programmed cell death. What do these cell deaths look like? There are various criteria for defining that landmark morphological set of changes associated with programmed cell death, apoptosis. These are apoptotic deaths by every criterion we can test. And yet, this core fundamental pathway is not needed. There's some other way to get there. We have some hints about how this pathway is activated, but the mechanism we do not know, and that means we're not out of business yet. There's still more things to discover. So with that, I want to make one overreaching statement. The studies that we did were fundamentally basic research. We did not target any disease. We worked on an organism that at the point I started was not only obscure, but people thought irrelevant. The studies we did were fundamentally genetic in nature at the beginning. Genetic studies are often abstract and formalisms. I didn't know if what we found would be relevant to any organism other than C. elegans, and yet our findings have established mechanisms that appear to be universal amongst animals and that are providing the basis for a variety of explorations into new treatments for a very broad variety of human diseases. And I think there is a very fundamental message here, and one I hope that everyone in the audience, students and the rest of us, will always keep in mind, be it for defining our own research programs or in following the advice we heard at dinner last night and talking to funding agencies and the public. Basic research is the driver. I wrote here of biomedical knowledge, but for this audience, I would say of scientific knowledge. Basic research, curiosity-based research, is the future of all that we can and will know, and it is crucially important for intellectual reasons and for pragmatic socioeconomic reasons that basic research be supported appropriately from those sources that are best suited to do this, and that, in my view, is national governments. So with that little bit, what I want to do is to end by showing you a celebratory reunion from 2002, and also I've listed here those people currently in and previously in the lab whose work I alluded to today, our studies of programmed cell death, have been but one of a variety of adventures we've had, and certainly one of the ones that has been most rewarding and most exciting. And I'll stop with that, and thank you very much.
Programmed Cell Death in Development and Disease lautete heute unser Thema auf diesem Sendeplatz. Es sprach der Nobelpreisträger für Medizin aus dem Jahr 2002, Professor Howard Robert Horwitz. Hinweisen dürfen wir Sie noch abschließend auf einen außergewöhnlichen Sendeplatz am morgigen Freitag auf D-Radio Wissen. In Abänderung des Programmschemas wiederholen wir dann um 20.05 Uhr den Hörsaal von gestern mit dem SPD-Politiker und ehemaligen Bundesfinanzminister Peer Steinbrück. Der Titel: Risse im Fundament von Staat und Gesellschaft.